This is Sports Talk from AM 870 WKAR.
This program content is made possible in part by WKAR listeners.
Hello and welcome to Sports Talk here on WKAR AM 870. I am Matt Ludke joining you once again. I've got Alex Scharg in the booth, and we've got tons to talk about today. Lots of interesting playoff action both on the ice and the hardwood last night. The Red Wings with a 3-2 overtime victory. The Warriors blow a 16-point lead in 4 minutes. And the unbeatable Miami Heat fall once again to the Chicago Bulls, this time at home. First things first, Alex, let's start out. Let's keep it in the state of Michigan with the Red Wings and Ducks. Now, they tie the series at 2-2, and it seemed like a vintage Red Wings game. You've had big shot totals for the Wings compared to considerably smaller ones for their opponents, outshooting Anaheim 48-33. It was 27-15 after two periods, and for a while there, it looked like they were never going to break through the wall that is Jonas Hiller. He had a shutout streak of just over 100 minutes, 101 minutes and 18 seconds to be exact. Now, the Ducks, in addition to Hiller, were pretty fantastic defensively through the first two periods, you know, forcing the Red Wings into tough, low-percentage shots. And, you know, even though they were peppering Hiller with as many as they possibly could, not many of them were, very great scoring chances. And when they were, Hiller seemed to be there. Now, you know, they finally break through early in the third period. It seems like that's been the theme of the series. If they're going to score, it's going to be early in a period. Brendan Smith, one of the young guys, and that was one of the big themes of last night as well. He just, crushes a shot from the point. It ricochets off some traffic in front of the net and dives down between Hiller's legs. And it seemed like after that, everything started to come around for the Red Wings. You know, they started to really attack. You could tell they kind of smelled a blood in the water, so to speak. But, it was 1-1 for a while. And then, a few minutes later, it seemed like David Steckel here, 10 minutes and 40 seconds into the third, he scores to make it 2-1 Ducks after, Jimmy Howard was kind of run into by one of his own guys. You know, Steckel's right there to clean up a rebound, and, it seemed like, here we go again, a game where the Red Wings outshoot their opponent by 15 or 16, and then, they lose on a couple of fluky goals, but it was not meant to be. And after Johan Franzen almost tied it with what appeared to be a goal for a second there, but the referees waved off, and it was held up by the video review after goalie Jonas Hiller had covered it up and, it was inconclusive whether it was actually over the line or not. Just a few seconds after that, 13:27 into the third, Pavel Datsyuk, he really put the team on his back, so to speak. Carried it into the zone on the left wing and just rifled a wrist shot right over Hiller for the tying goal. It knocked the water bottle off. It almost didn't even look like it went in. It was in and out so quick. Now, you look at what Datsyuk can do, and he's obviously the leader of the team. I think the big key for the Wings this postseason and, even the end of the season when they were just fighting to get into the playoffs has been, can they mix, the tried and true Zetterberg and Datsyuk and Franzen with some of these younger players like a Damian Bruner, like a, Gustav Nyquist, like a Brendan Smith. And it seemed like it was a nice blend last night for the first time really all series that they got contributions from everyone. 4:50 left in OT. Nyquist somehow got a nice pass from Anderson, and he's, streaking down the ice. Jonas Hiller doesn't come out to play the puck. I think he's going to regret that. He stays in his crease, ends up poke-checking it away at the last second, but unfortunately it bounces right in front of the goal. He's outstretched, out of position, and Bruner comes in and cleans things up and ends the game. Big celebration. Going forward in this series, Alex, do you like the Red Wings' chances? And if so, why?
Yeah, and obviously when we saw Pavel Datsyuk carry the team on his back, I mean, that probably relies on Datsyuk now. And, as far as basically carrying the team on the back, I mean, for most of the games that they win, Pavel Datsyuk has a pretty big contribution. So, yeah, I mean, they took one. They lost one at the Joe, and in un-Red Wing fashion, yet, I mean, they're probably going to go back to Anaheim and compete just like they did at the Joe. I mean, as long as Datsyuk's playing at his best.
Right, and it seems like he is. You know, the guy is a workhorse. Once he gets the puck, I mean, good luck taking it away from him because, you know, he's a magician with his stick. And, gosh, he's amazing to watch because, you know, you think he's stopped and he, you know, spins and twirls and somehow he's wide open again. And, you know, he just always creating chances. And one of the things that he does so well is, you know, kind of draw the attention of the defense and, you know, create opportunities for other players. And, you know, all it takes is some of these games or, you know, just one little bounce and things change. You know, after the series was kind of decided with power plays and penalty kills, last night there were only four penalties, three of which were on the Red Wings. But, you know, it didn't seem to matter so much. They had a good, effective power play, didn't break through. But, man, when you watched the game, it was, I don't know how people survive playoff hockey and, you know, especially overtime playoff hockey. It is so stressful. Even if you don't have a lot, you know, invested in the game itself, sometimes it's tough to watch just because it's so high stakes. Now, you know, it really did look like a vintage Red Wings game. You know, 48-33, it just seemed like one of those games where the Ducks were going to come down, take a wild shot, and it would somehow wrangle in past Jimmy Howard. But, Alex, you know, after the 4-0 drubbing in Game 3, do you think, you know, this game kind of restored Howard's confidence in himself and maybe the team's confidence in Howard? Or, you know, the big game in Anaheim coming up in Game 5, do you think he can hold it together and maybe give us some consistent efforts like he did last night?
Yeah, I mean, we have to wait to see in terms of if he can hold it together, but I'm sure his confidence is up. I mean, only 2 goals opposed to 4, you can't go wrong.
Yeah, and you know, even though Hiller, I think, probably had a better game, you know, he was very impressive the entire night. I don't think you can really pin this loss on him. It did seem like, you know, slowly but surely they sort of, you know, took control of the game. And even though they were getting those shots early, it didn't seem like they were great chances. But then in the third period, they kind of found some space and started taking high quality shots. And obviously the goals started to come with that. You know, listeners, let us know what you think of the Wings victory and their chances going forward. 517-355-9527. Of course, that's 355-WKAR or toll free at 877-952-7870. So the young guns, you know, Damian Bruner, Gustav Nyquist, you know, Brendan Smith, all of them coming together. And even, you know, in the big picture, you know, you look at this series, and even if they lose, I think, you know, this is a great experience for them going forward. You know, a lockout shortened season this year, they had to fight to make the playoffs. These are the kind of, you know, experiences and I guess seasons, you know, to just generalize it, that you cut your teeth with if you're going to be an NHL player. This is a great experience for these guys to learn from players like Datsyuk and Zetterberg. And, you know, Zetterberg might not have scored, but he had, I think, at least 7 shots on goal. He was very active. And when you have 2 guys like that in Zetterberg and Datsyuk who are going to kind of, you know, lead the charge, so to speak, and play by example and, you know, lead by example, I guess, you know, that only bodes well. You know, the Red Wings have long been one of the storied franchises. We've got a 22-year playoff streak that, you know, they fortunately kept alive this year by the skin of their teeth. But, you know, when you look at what this kind of experience can do for the young guys going forward, I think it's only a good thing. You know, these are the kind of runs that Datsyuk and Zetterberg were making when they were younger, you know, just up-and-coming players with guys like Lidstrom. And you know, you go back, oh boy, tons of play. You know, Holmstrom was a mainstay for years and years and years. I mean, it's not like these guys have never played before. You know, they were brought up in a similar fashion where they had veteran leadership on the team, and you know, they were able to kind of carry the torch after those guys moved on. And I think that might be what you're seeing here, because you know, Datsyuk and Zetterberg aren't getting any younger, and I'm not suggesting that they're going to retire anytime soon or anything like that. But the question coming into the series and the postseason was, do they have the depth? And I think you're seeing it kind of, kind of coming along, you know, slowly but surely. I mean, obviously, it was sort of, you know, one step forward and two steps back in terms of, you know, games two and three, where they really struggled. And, you know, you saw it with a 4-0 loss. They definitely struggled. Alex, do you think that the young guys can, you know, kind of keep it together? Or do you think we're in for another up and down few games? Do you think this is going to go seven, or do you think we can string something together here?
Yeah, well, I think this next game in Anaheim has a lot to do with foul play. What I mean by that is, of course, you don't want to see another Advocator hit. But you can't have another play where you have either Allen from the Ducks or you have a defenseman from the Detroit Red Wings running into their own goalie. I mean, both of those goals within the last, you know, last 20 minutes of the third were caused because Hiller went down and because Howard went down. And sure, it was because they were going for the puck. It maybe not a, maybe could have been accidental, but you've got to know where you are on the ice. Sure, we're not playing the game. We can't really say you should have done something. But, I mean, this is playoff hockey. You know, you can't just sit there and foul on a goalie when it's a one-goal game.
Right. I mean, you make a mistake and you're going to pay for it. And, you know, both teams did last night. And that Nyquist, you know, he had that breakaway. And, yeah, the Ducks were definitely doing all they could. And, you know, rightfully so. It's overtime and this guy has a breakaway. If he scores, it's over. So they definitely sold out to take him out. And, you know, in doing so, I think they kind of, you know, brushed up against Hiller. You know, threw him out of position a little bit. He was already sort of, you know, spread all the way across the crease trying to cover as much ground as he could. And, you know, no one kind of was able to come in and clean up when Bruner was there. He was the only guy in front of the net. He was all alone. Had he missed, it would have been a tragedy. But, you know, he's right there to clean it up. Both of the Ducks committed to Nyquist and, you know, credit Nyquist for that with his great speed and Anderson with the pass. It was a great play because it started out as maybe a chance for the Ducks, you know. Kindle kind of wrestled it away from a Duck and, you know, started the break. And then before you know it, they were down the ice and the game was over. And really that is, again, that's all it takes. And, you know, you nudge your goalie one way and he's a little bit out of position. He's not where he wants to be. And that's really all it takes. Playoff hockey is very high stakes and especially when you're talking about overtime hockey. Now, in other scores through the playoffs, you had Boston beating Toronto 5-2 last night. The Rangers held on over the Washington Capitals 4-3 with a late goal in the third. And the LA Kings came back to beat the St. Louis Blues. So, you know, you look at the landscape of the NHL, and it's really anybody's game, but I think that comes with the territory of playoff hockey. You know, the Red Wings have as good a shot as any. I think, you know, people might have been saying that this series was over when Abdelkader went out, and you know, when you see them lose 4-0 in such convincing fashion like they did over the weekend, you know, the outlook wasn't great, I'll admit, and I think anyone would. But, you know, this team battles, and, you know, if the last seven games of the season taught us anything, it's that when the backs are against the wall, they're definitely going to bring it. And, you know, they have so far. They got beat badly in game one and, you know, pretty badly in game three. But at the same time, they're battling back, winning these overtime games. Now, I would like to see them win a game in regulation. Absolutely. You know, these overtime games are, again, taking years off my life and, you know, hair off my head. But I think, you know, any way you get the victory is important. And, you know, a W is a W at the end of the day. We are going to take our first quick break here. We'll come back. We've got lots of NBA action to talk about, maybe a little Percy Snow, some MSU scheduling, and maybe Tyler Ellis. Be back right after this with more sports talk here on AM 870.
On Talk of the Nation, we talk about what you're talking about.
I turned on the radio and I heard this and I nearly drove off the freeway.
I have experienced a lot of what you've been talking about.
I'm Neil Cownan. Surprising voices, interesting conversations on the topics you're talking about. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That's Talk of the Nation coming up today at 2 p.m. right here on WKAR AM 870.
Skies will be partly sunny this afternoon and we'll see a high temperature around 76. Partly cloudy tonight with lows in the lower 50s. Partly sunny also on Wednesday with highs in the mid-70s. And mostly sunny until midday Thursday, then becoming mostly cloudy later on. A slight chance of thunderstorms and a high in the lower 70s.
Welcome back, WKAR AM 870. This is Sports Talk. I am Matt Ludke. I've got Alex Scharg in the booth. And Alex, let's talk a little basketball, NBA variety. And last night, it looked like up until about 4 minutes left in that Warriors-Spurs game that it was going to be known as, you know, the Night of Rust, where the teams that had swept their first-round series, of course, the Spurs over the Lakers and the Heat over the Bucks, that would ultimately come back to bite them, you know, with both teams looking a little out of sorts to start their games and unable to beat the teams that had to fight for their playoff lives, especially Chicago. But, you know, we'll start out in Miami because, you know, that was the first game. It was a 93-86 upset win for the Bulls. And this is, again, the team that snapped the Heat's 27-game win streak. This one was a 12-game win streak. And, you know, you look at this effort by the Bulls. They don't have Luol Deng, who is, you know, still suffering some ill effects from a spinal tap to, you know, verify if he had viral meningitis. He does not. He's still too weak to play. You've got Kirk Heinrich with a calf injury and Derrick Rose, who's been out the whole year with an ACL injury. Those are three of their top players. They're all out, and it didn't matter. They still came away with a 7-point win on the road. And I think, you know, most of the credit has to go to Tom Thibodeau, their coach, who is clearly one of the elite coaches in the NBA. He believes in his system. His players believe in both his system and him, and they all seem to believe in each other, no matter who it is. If it's Marco Bellinelli hitting a big three, if it's Taj Gibson fighting on the glass, if it's Joakim Noah being a warrior, or if it's Nate Robinson taking over when the game is on the line. Nate Robinson, 5'9", one of the more, eccentric players in the NBA. He's exciting. He loves preening for the cameras. He had 27 points and 9 assists yesterday. You know, the Bulls down 7 midway through the fourth quarter. They go on a 10-0 run over the last 2 minutes, 7 of which were scored by Nate Robinson. And they come away with a victory. They outscore the Heat 35-24 in the fourth quarter. And this is a team that's built on toughness. And, you know, Robinson, again, he had 10 stitches after a collision with LeBron in the first half and comes out in the second and closes the game. And, you know, Nate Robinson is one of those guys that you know, he lines up for a jump shot and you're saying, no, 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 no. Yes, once he makes it. And, you know, in spurts, he can be, an elite scorer. I mean, he was doing whatever he wanted towards the end of the game last night. And, you know, the big story with the Bulls all season has been Derrick Rose. And now that they have a 1-0 lead, Alex, I'm going to ask you, do you think there's any chance Rose comes back during this series or maybe in the playoffs in the future if they advance past this series, or is he done?
Well, I think that win definitely put a lot into perspective for him. I mean, if they were maybe down 2-0, if they lost that first game, it looked like they needed him. I think it's probably more favorable for him to come back. But now you look at this team, you look at Noah after the game, you know, a fired up press conference, and this guy, you know, I mean, you could definitely tell that the team knows that without Rose, they're not the same. They know that without Deng, they're not the same. But I think that if they did not say anything about the injuries and they went together, they did the best they could, they had no distractions, quote unquote, and they went in that game and lost, then I think Rose maybe probably would step in. I think the fact that his team's winning, yes, he could come back, but as long as a win's a win, like you said, it's just a W at the end of the day.
Right. And, you know, I think I disagree with that. I think, let's say the Bulls and Heat, you know, the Heat jump out 2-0, I think he'd be done. You know, he's been cleared since March 8th by doctors to play. He says he doesn't feel ready. And, you know, he's a former MVP. He's the youngest MVP in league history. So whenever he feels ready is fine. And I think most of the Bulls players, if not all, I think pretty much everyone inside the Bulls organization is okay with it. You know, if he's going to take a whole year off and come back next season, you know, better than ever. But, you know, if they get up 2-0, you've got a legitimate shot at winning the NBA title. A very legitimate shot, because Miami is clearly the biggest hurdle left. You know, Memphis in the West is good. Oklahoma City lost Russell Westbrook. I mean, the Spurs had to rally from 16 down to beat the Warriors. This is anyone's game. If they go up 2-0, you know, I feel like Rose would almost be more inclined to come back then. You know, even if he's not coming in to play 29 minutes, you know, 40 minutes a game, if he comes in and gives him 19 minutes off the bench, you know, just a little scoring punch, because, you know, that's really the only thing they're missing. They play great defense. They run a great system. He comes back, you know, if you have a chance to win a title, you're inclined to take it. And yeah, he's their franchise player. They're taking the long view, but you know, I think if they win another game here, you know, I don't know if they'll steal another one in Miami. That's a tall order. But maybe if they go up 2-1, I think it starts to become more of a conversation. Now, the other question I had for you is, why don't they just say that he's done? What is the harm in saying he's done for the year? And then if he comes back, it's a surprise for everyone. Why are they keeping this, you know, wouldn't it be better to just squash it, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, there's no reason why you can't say if he's out or not. Yeah, sure, if he can't play, fine. You know, you don't want to rush the guy. Yeah, I don't think anyone has a problem with that.
He's your franchise player. Let him rest. I just don't see the point in saying, well, maybe he'll come back. You know, and Rose himself is saying, well, there's a chance. Just say you're not coming back, and you know, then this goes away. Then you have no distractions. Then it's just, you know, it is what it is. But maybe you're right. Maybe they're keeping it around so he can kind of take the heat off the team and they can focus on basketball. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see.
We will, and it's going to be an interesting series because, you know, Nate Robinson, man. In spurts, he can be pretty tough to stop. He's the only player in the last 15 years to have 11 points and 6 assists in a playoff fourth quarter. That's going to be a trivia question. I can guarantee it, because I don't think anyone in their right mind would guess that Nate Robinson is the player to do that. But sure enough, you know, the little guy out of Washington, he is fun to watch. But you know, you looked at the end of the game, and it just seemed like, you know, the Heat were a little rusty. And you know, they started out the game horribly, missed their first 7 shots. They shot 26% in the first quarter, 33% in the first half. They were 3 of 13 on 3-pointers, and that's what they, you know, pride their game on. Players not named LeBron or Wade shot 16 of 45 from the field. Which is not great. LeBron himself struggled in the first half. You know, he had just received his MVP award, promptly went 1 for 6 for 2 points in the first half. Now, granted, he finished strong with 22 in the second half, you know, a total of 24 on 8 of 17 shooting. But he certainly wasn't the MVP last night, at least in that first half. And, you know, down the stretch, you know, down 2, Wade takes a pretty dumb 3 with a lot of time left on the shot clock. It was not an open look by any means, and Wade is by no means a 3-point shooter, so why he was doing that, I have no idea. But, you know, following that up, the next drive down the court, LeBron airballs a turnaround jumper. So it seemed like the Bulls came ready to play. You know, they were definitely the more well-prepared team. You know, maybe they're in a groove from that 7-game series versus the Nets. They kept that momentum rolling. You know, you get contributions from guys like Jimmy Butler, the second-year player out of Marquette, who really, I don't think many people knew about coming into this season. He's played 48 minutes in the last 3 games, you know, the entire game, the last 3, all 3 of them. He had 21 and 14 rebounds last night. He looks like he could be one of the elite wing players in at least the Eastern Conference. You know, he's got the perfect build to stop LeBron, although he was not able to do that last night on some of those drives. LeBron is just too strong. But, you know, he's a guy who maybe can develop into that LeBron stopper. And one more question for you here, Alex. Going forward, and again, this is not just this season. I'm talking the long haul here. Do you see Chicago emerging as the team in the East that will consistently challenge Miami? It seems like they're kind of a one-horse race at this point, but with Rose coming back and with these contributions that they're getting from everyone, do you see the Bulls being that arch nemesis of the Heat going forward this decade?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, though, I thought this was a New York-Miami series to start, but now with the Knicks being a little scary, like you said, we're not so sure. We're not so sure if the Knicks can hold on, but yeah, I mean, I honestly don't think that the Bulls will have a shot at the Heat. I think the Heat are going to come back and win the series. But I think if Derrick Rose comes back, then I think it would be a Bulls series.
Right. And, you know, yeah, you said it looked like it was going to be New York. Who knows what they're doing right now? But as far as New York or Chicago going forward, I think I would lean towards Chicago just because, and you know, this is no offense to Mike Woodson, who I think is a terrific coach, but Tom Thibodeau is probably a top. He's a top three coach. It's probably Popovich himself, and you know, maybe a Doc Rivers in there, or an Eric Spoelstra, or one of those two, but. He is, you know, undoubtedly a premier coach in the NBA. And, you know, if you're looking for a team that's going to consistently compete, I would much rather take the team that prides itself on defense and rebounding and running their system as opposed to a team like the Knicks, which relies on, you know, Carmelo Anthony being a team player, which it doesn't seem like he's really, you know, interested in doing right now, and, you know, shooting a lot of threes. So I think I would take Chicago as the safer bet moving forward. You know, listeners, let us know what you think. Maybe the Pistons sneak in there if they rebuild the team. 517-355-9527. Of course, that's 355-WKAR or toll free at 877-952-7870. So, yeah, I mean, Nate Robinson and the Bulls, you know, game seven, it was Joakim Noah. Last night it was Nate Robb. It seems like every night they're getting a different guy to step up and be the guy. You know, they are a MASH unit, to put it kindly, and they're still doing it, and it's incredible. You know, they're so much fun to watch. They play together. They believe in each other, and you know, even though they're, you know, grinding out these 93-86 wins, they're incredibly entertaining. You know, it's a team that prides itself on defense, and you can tell. And they give 100%, 100% of the time. There are no plays off if you're playing for the Bulls. They're an impressive group, and you know they kind of are gaining a little air of that team of destiny. Now, while I kind of agree with you, Alex, I think the Heat are going to win the series. You know, they just have the better play. I mean, they have the three top players in the series, I think, are all Heat players. You know, Noah might be better than Bosch. He certainly was last night, but. You know, it's just too much talent on the Heat, and, you know, they won 27 games for a reason. But if there's a team that knows how to beat them, it's the Bulls. And it's going to be an interesting series, and I think, you know, it'll probably go six or seven games, but it's going to be a fun one to watch. Now, speaking of fun ones to watch, I don't know if you stayed up for this, but Golden State and San Antonio, this thing looked like it was over with 4 minutes left. Golden State's up 16, and then the Spurs just did the Spurs thing to do, which was close the game strong. You know, they scored at least 15 straight. I believe it was 16. Tie it up, take it to overtime, goes to a second overtime. And then finally, regrettably, at least for me, in terms of my rooting interest, Manu Ginobili hits a big three to put them up 129-127, and they win in the second overtime. But this one was crazy. Stephen Curry... this line is pretty ridiculous. He had 44 and 11 assists on, brace yourself, 18 for 35 shooting. And I know I gave Carmelo some crap yesterday about shooting 28 times, but I think he made like six. So when you look at Curry, yeah, he was 18 of 35, but at one point I believe he was like 18 of 27, which is a little bit better. Actually, it's really good. So, I mean, you look at a guy like him, he was lighting it up. And the third quarter has been his quarter this whole playoffs. He had 22 points, including 14 in a row, pretty much to end the quarter. And they were spectacular. And this guy, you know, Alex, I don't know if you think, you know, here's a question. Do you think he's the most exciting player in these NBA playoffs, or do you still give it to LeBron just on reputation alone?
I don't know if LeBron's more reputation. I mean, he's just a great player. You know, LeBron, when you look at him in games, I mean, this guy just is electrifying. But is Steph Curry the most electrifying player? You can make a case. But I think the bigger story coming out of that game last night was the defensive letdown, the defensive confusion on Manu Ginobili's three. I mean, he was wide open.
Harrison Barnes, rookie mistake.
You could blame Harrison Barnes.
Yeah,
but
he left him. He left Ginobili to go with the cutter, who came up the center of the court, and there's Ginobili. That's the one guy you do not leave.
Sure, but at the same time, Is that more of a coach's thing? Do you talk to Mark Jackson about what he said to his players on this last play? Maybe Mark Jackson should say, "Hey, you got to switch on all screens. You got to switch on all cutters."
You know, maybe he did, but he's got a bunch of rookies on his team. I mean, that is the big thing. This is youth versus experience. And for a while there, it looked like youth was going to win out. And then, of course, you know, the Spurs kind of did their thing and took control of it. But really, I mean, the big change in the game occurred when Klay Thompson fouled out, which happened with, I believe, roughly 5 minutes left. You know, he fouls out. The Spurs decide to put Kawhi Leonard, who is 6'7" and has, like, you know, bigger hands than, like, the door here. Like, the guy is huge. He was guarding Curry, and it seemed to kind of slow him down. Curry just went 2 for 6 after that switch. He was 0 for 7 on jump shots in the fourth quarter and overtime, which certainly hurt them. But, oh, God, he is such an exciting player. And the Spurs, you know, you can't say enough about them. Tim Duncan had 19 and 11. He was also, you know, suffering from flu-like symptoms. While it wasn't quite a Luol Deng-type sickness, he was certainly limited. But just the way that they battled back, Tony Parker finished with 28, 8, and 8. Danny Green hit some huge shots down the stretch. He finished with 22. It seemed like all the threes that they needed at the end of the game, they were going to hit. And we talked about Ginobili. He had 16 points. He finished 5 of 20 from the floor. So it's not like he had a great game. But even so, you can't leave him when there's, you know, 3 seconds left in the game. He's going to make the shot. He is that type of player. He's always been that type of player. He lives for the big moment. And, you know, just before that, with, I believe, 44 seconds left, he took an ill-advised three, missed it, and that kind of led the Warriors to come back, because this was a seesaw game once it got to that overtime. But Curry's third quarter, when he had those 22 points, and this kind of goes along with the question I asked you, is he the most, you know, exciting player in these playoffs? I think he is, and I think part of it is that he is 6'3", 180 pounds. He looks like, you know, at least in comparison to everyone else on the court, he looks like a normal guy. You know, he looks like he's just one of those guys who kind of walks out, doesn't look like anything, and then he's just amazing. And, you know, when you have a guy who, as soon as he crosses half court, is in shooting range, I mean, there's not many players like that. He's, you know, he was hitting jump shots from way beyond the three-point line. He had one move on Tony Parker that I made sure I was going to mention. You know, he's making a few dribble moves, puts the ball on the ground, rolls it to his left, you know, picks it up, and promptly just fires a three-pointer right in Parker's face. It was incredible. I don't think I've seen something like that on the court. And in real time, it looked like he just mishandled the ball, picked it up, and shot it, and it somehow went in. But then you looked at it on replay, and it looked like, oh, God, this guy's doing this on purpose. He's insane. It's so much fun to watch. And even when they put the 6'7 Leonard on him, you know, he would, you know, he just kind of dribbled down one possession. He dribbled down and took Kawhi right in for a right-handed layup. And then the next trip down the court, he did the exact same thing, but with a left-handed layup. And it was, there's just so many ways that he can beat you. And I don't know how many scoop layups he had, and they're just fun to watch. It's fun to watch this guy who is, you know, relatively short and relatively thin of build, just kind of go out there and make the game his. And, you know, he had 44 points. Of course, they would have liked if he had, you know, 47, but, you know, it was not meant to be. And, you know, this has been the problem with the Warriors. You know, they almost blew Game 6 against Denver, blew a big lead down the stretch, were able to hold on. They said they had learned how to close games. I think Mark Jackson will be, you know, preaching that even more after last night. But, you know, they just started running out of players, too. And that's the thing in overtime games. You know, Klay Thompson fouls out. Draymond Green fouls out. Richard Jefferson, unfortunately, had to see the floor. If you're a Warriors fan, that's a bad sign if Richard Jefferson is playing. He promptly came in, and after a Green steal where he gave it to him for what looked like a breakaway layup, he was fouled and promptly missed 2 free throws. So that's kind of the way things were going down the stretch. And a little tidbit here, this makes 30 straight losses for the Warriors at the Spurs. Now, Alex, I'm sure, you know, you were watching, and I'm sure you saw this stat. Can you tell me the last time the Warriors beat the Spurs at San Antonio?
I don't remember what year it was, but it was a while ago.
All right. Valentine's Day, 1997.
Wow, okay.
Which is, you know, later that summer, the Spurs draft a guy named Tim Duncan, who came in and sort of ushered in a dynasty. So 16 years now since the Warriors have won at San Antonio, and hopefully for them, they can get it done in game two, or else, it's going to be another year added to that tally. Just an incredible game. If you didn't watch it, go check out the highlights, because there are plenty of them. Draymond Green, he had 10-7, not quite the game he had versus Denver to clinch it, but at the same time, he was playing good minutes, picked up fouls that he didn't need to, of course, and that was obviously unfortunate. He had a pretty cheap ticky-tack one against Danny Green over on an over-the-back foul that I personally did not agree with, but perhaps that's just because I'm a big fan of Draymond. But the Warriors, they had him on the ropes, and going forward, Alex, this is the test. Do you think that the Warriors can kind of rebound from this and maybe take pride in the fact that they were up 16 with 4 minutes left, or do you think this is one of those, I don't want to say finishing blow because it was game one, but do you think this kind of hurts their confidence to the point that this series, for all intents and purposes, is over?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it'd be over if maybe you saw some really bad play in the next couple of games. They're down 2-0, 3-0, but they've got a long way to go. They're still, a pretty dominant team.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're the Warriors, you look at that 16-point lead and say, yeah, we can dominate this team. And it looked like they were doing it. But, at the end there, they just fell apart, and they need to learn how to finish games. Just because you're up 16 with 4 minutes left, it certainly is not over. And I think that's a hard lesson to learn, and hopefully they learn it, because this is the thing that, again, this happens all the time. People say that you can't win an NBA championship your first time when you're really contending. You have to kind of go through these growing pains, so to speak, and this kind of looked like the older brother beating up on the younger brother, just because they had it. They really did, but the youth, they made all sorts of mistakes down the stretch, whether it was bad offensive possessions or terrible defensive possessions. It seemed like there was like a 30-second period where the Spurs just got three layups, and that's the opposite of what you want to do if you're trying to hold a lead. And as soon as Thompson went out, it seemed like the wheels really fell off, and he's not even their best player, but it seemed like they needed someone else, another option offensively, because it just was not happening after he left the game. So we're going to take another quick break here. We'll come back. We'll talk a little Percy Snow and a little bit about Tyler Ulis, a potential future Spartan. So we'll take a quick break after these messages on WKAR AM 870.
What do you do when you're little and you know you can't be like your mother? I adore and am proud of my mother, but what she wants from me is blind adherence to the mystifying virtue of seemly behavior.
On the next Fresh Air, Patricia Volk talks about her new memoir, Shocked, about her relationship with her mother. And we'll hear an excerpt of a recent lecture by Martin Scorsese about film history. Join us.
That's Fresh Air coming up today at 3 p.m. right here on AM 870 WKAR Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Lavery with the forecast. For the rest of the day, look for mostly cloudy skies and a high in the upper 20s. Then partly cloudy tonight, a low around 15. Some sun over the weekend, partly sunny on Saturday, highs in the upper 20s, and mostly sunny on Sunday, again, highs in the upper 20s.
Welcome back to Sports Talk here on WKAR AM 870. I am Matt Ludke with Alex Sharg in the booth. And Alex, we got some historical Spartan news today. Percy Snow was just announced as a member of the 2013 class for the College Football Hall of Fame. It is the 11th member from Michigan State, and its 7th player. He is the most decorated middle linebackers in program history. From 87 to 89, he started in George Perlis's 4-3 defense, and he had 473 tackles, second in program history. So, you look at a guy like Percy Snow, clearly a Spartan great, and definitely one of the greats of his era. And, he was the MVP of MSU's Rose Bowl victory over USC, which, our last Rose Bowl appearance, which now seems like it was forever and ever and ever ago. But, sooner or later, hopefully we will get back. He was a two-time first-team All-American, first-round draft pick for the Kansas City Chiefs. You know, he is well deserving of this kind of honor. And, you know, you look at the legacy he's left and you see guys like Max Bulla and before him, legacy guys like Caleb Thornhill. It seems like middle linebacker is a good place to play for the Spartans. And, you know, Alex, when you look at the grander scheme of things, was Percy our best ever, or maybe the best linebacker we've ever had?
Yeah, he was pretty darn good.
I mean, yeah, it's tough to argue.
You look at like what he did in that USC game, and then you look at some of the guys that have been inducted. I mean, you look at even some of the great coaches. I mean, you'll see a Webster, you'll see the Perlitz, you'll see some pretty darn good coaches. But if you look at coaches and players, and then Duffy Daugherty, this was a guy that played in that era. So, I mean, and if you look at eras of Michigan State, I mean, we'd have to call an expert for this one, but. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely joining an elite group.
Right.
He's the 11th player ever, I think. So that's pretty. I mean, I think it's past two. I mean, he's the only guy to ever win the Lombardi and Buckus in the same season.
Exactly.
So he's made a pretty big milestone for himself.
Yeah, take that, man, Ty Teo. He joins, Don Coleman, George Webster, Bubba Smith, Brad Van Pelt, and Gene Washington as players in that, College Football Hall of Fame. It just seems like this is another great, kind of a thing for the history of Spartan football, which I think doesn't get enough credit because, you know, while we've kind of been mired in mediocrity for a majority of the last, 40 years, there are certainly bright spots, and Percy Snow was definitely part of one of those bright spots back in 87 and through 89. He's also going to be added to the MSU Ring of Fame, so it looks like he's going to be inducted November 2nd, game against Michigan at Spartan Stadium. So there's another, kind of outside event that's going to happen at that game. That is the marquee matchup of the season. And, when you kind of, we're going to transition here to the current football season, and that game against Michigan, November 2nd, is clearly the premier home game of the year. The MSU schedule, has been released for a while. We did just find out that we're going to open up against Western Michigan on a Friday night, per usual, with these last few seasons, starting the year out on a Friday night. It will be a night game, 8 p.m., it'll be on the Big Ten Network. It'll be our only Big Ten Network game that is at night. You'd think it's actually kind of interesting. Western Michigan plays more primetime games on the Big Ten Network than Michigan State does. But sometimes that's just the way the schedule shakes out. Now, when you look at the home schedule, at least, we start out with Western, of course. Then we go to South Florida, Youngstown State, Indiana for homecoming, Purdue, Michigan, and Minnesota. And that doesn't really jump out at you, and I don't know if it should. South Florida has a couple of players. They have a guy, Aaron Lynch, who used to play for Notre Dame and was a pretty darn good defensive lineman. He transferred to South Florida. He should be on the field next fall. But, you look at that schedule, and, yeah, nothing really jumps out at you. But, fans who are looking for more competitive, more, eye-popping matchups, be careful what you wish for, because we did just go 0-4 in the Big Ten home games last season and, lost that game to Notre Dame. That was pretty demoralizing, and it just seems like, hey, at this point, we should kind of take any wins that we can possibly get, and, if we have a relatively easy-looking home slate, no offense to any of the teams I mentioned, we'll gladly take advantage. Of course, that leaves tough road games, against in the conference, and of course Notre Dame on the road. The former national championship contenders. But Alex, you look at that schedule, and it looks pretty manageable. If I was guessing here, I'd say that tickets for that Michigan game would probably cost you more money than tickets for all of the other games combined. If you're going to a secondary market there, when you look at that home schedule again, Western, South Florida, Youngstown, Indiana, Purdue, Michigan, Minnesota. At least when I'm looking at it, the optimist in me says we can win all those games. But the pessimist in me, who watched football last year, says, man, we could lose four out of those games. When you look at that slate, do you see us bouncing back at home? Do you see us defending the home turf? Maybe not a perfect season, but at least, 6-1, 7-1.
Right. Well, look at the strength of schedule. A lot easier than last year.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think they definitely could.
And you know, that's kind of been the you know, the big thing the last few years has been the tough schedule. You know, they played about as tough as a Big Ten schedule as anybody did last year. You know, games against Ohio State, games against Wisconsin, in those cross divisional matchups. You know, they avoided Penn State, but was last year really the best year to avoid Penn State? Who knows? You know, you look at them going forward, and it's anybody's guess where they go with those scholarship limitations. But it just seems like even though there's not many marquee games, and you know, if Western Michigan is your primetime matchup, it doesn't say much about the other games you have. But you know, I think we can definitely pick up some victories here. You know, I 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 victories that we should get. I'd say Michigan's a toss-up. You know, regardless of their talent, I think Michigan's always a toss-up just because of the nature of the rivalry. You know, everybody's going to raise their game for that one. But you know, I think if we can defend our home turf and go 6-1 at home, you know, then all you have to do is win 3 road games and you're in business. You know, and you're back to that 9-win plateau that, you know, I think people are kind of desperate for us to reach. You know, I think double digits is a little excessive if you're kind of predicting the season just because of the struggles of the offense last year, and you know, we didn't see anything in the spring game, which, you know, granted, it's tough to judge the spring game, but the problems that existed last year look like they're still here. So, you know, plus a few more when you have holes left by guys like Le'Veon Bell and Deion Sims. So, Alex, I mean, you alluded to the strength of schedule, and clearly it's not what it was last year. But, you know, again, when you look at that home slate, do you see us going 0-4 in the Big Ten next year? I mean, it just doesn't look like it could happen.
No, absolutely not.
I mean, we dropped games to Iowa last year who went 4-8, so, you know, you never know. But, yeah, it could go either way, and I think we're going to bounce back to an extent. You know, we might not clean sweep it and go 8-0 or 7-0 rather at home. But I think 6 wins is certainly attainable on that home field. And, you know, maybe you drop one, Minnesota's rising, but it really doesn't look like any of those teams have the kind of talent we do, especially on defense. Now, Indiana gave us a scare last year. They can throw the ball and they move that up-tempo offense that kind of gives our defense trouble. Really, it gives any defense trouble, but I don't see them beating us, although homecoming is always a scary, scary proposition, as we again learned last year with Iowa. Homecoming does not guarantee victory. In fact, it almost always guarantees a tough, closely fought game. So let's switch it up for the last few minutes here. Let's move over to the basketball court. And yesterday, MSU extended an offer to 2014 point guard prospect Tyler Ulis out of Chicago Heights Marian Catholic. Now, you know, we were talking about Nate Robinson earlier in the show, a 5'9 point guard. Tyler Ulis, 5'8, but he is an ultra-quick player with a good shooting stroke. He's the 69th rated prospect on various websites, and he's got offers from schools like Iowa and Purdue and recently Florida. Now, he's got a couple of connections to MSU, and Alex, I want to get your take on whether you think that maybe will influence his decision. He is Travis Walton's cousin, who, of course, was a 4-year MSU player and, you know, a defensive player of the year. And he's AAU teammates with Alvin Ellis, one of the recruits that we just signed to the 2013 class. You know, so he's got connections. Now, Ellis, who, you know, we picked up and people kind of thought, oh, you know, he's a 3-star guy. He's, you know, not one of these, you know, blue chip prospects who's going to be a one and done. You know, he's been an active recruiter. He's trying to sway guys like Jahlil Okafor, who's the number one prospect, and Cliff Alexander and Tyus Jones and all these players to come to MSU. When you look at Ulis, and you know, we've been after Tyus Jones, who is like the number one point guard prospect, but he's probably a one and done. If you're Tom Izzo, are you more likely, or I guess, I don't know if you're more likely is the right way to put it, but are you looking, are you hoping more for Tyus Jones to come to your school and stay for 1 year, or a guy like Ulis to come to your school and stay for maybe 3 or 4 years?
Well, look at Michigan's case. You have Mitch McGarry. Did they expect Mitch McGarry as a, you know, just like Tyus Jones, a very highly talented guy, you know, 5-star guy, you know, probably a lot of people thought McGarry could have went this year. We saw there's one draft selection that had him going. So was McGarry a guy that was going to come in as the number two overall recruit earlier in the year and then maybe leave his first year? Could have been. Now you look at this guy. I mean, and I think it's really important that you don't want to worry about if he's going to be a one and done. But I think the point is if this guy is going to be a major contributor for the team. And the answer is yes. If you compare it to another guy, it's not like we don't have slots in the recruiting the recruiting class is still open. We do have some slots. So I think it would be worth to fill it, and then you could always worry about the next year.
Right. But, I mean, I think this Ullis offer, you know, I don't know if it's so much like a plan B if we don't get a Jones. And, you know, Jones and Okafor have stated many times in interviews that they want to play together. And we're one of the schools that is on both of their lists, along with schools like Duke, which is great because we learned how that went last year. But, you know, you look at this Ullis offer and it kind of seems like Izzo, you know, he went all in for Jabari Parker, you know, put all his eggs in Parker's basket and he got burned, you know. There's no easy way around it. Do you think this is kind of as a result of that, this offer? Do you think that the Parker decision and him going to Duke instead of Michigan State, you know, swinging big for the fences for these top five prospects, you know, do you think he's doing this just as sort of an insurance policy, so to speak?
You know what? I'm sure he liked Alvin Ellis in a lot of ways, but I mean, it could be. I mean, you see so many times when it comes to football, too, when there are more players, more recruits, that you see them offer their, you know, the guys they really want at the beginning, and then they go after the guys that they may not be able to get. So, yeah, it could have been an insurance offer. I don't think so. I think Tom Izzo would clearly say that he thinks this guy can play. So.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and it certainly seems like it. And, you know, we've obviously got some connections, again, through, you know, Travis Walton, who's, you know, still involved with the program. And he's still around East Lansing, you know, kicking it around East Lansing from time to time. You know, you see him at various events related to the team. And that can only help. I'm not saying that that's, you know, a done deal. But this guy is definitely a player who's worth getting. And, you know, if we get a Tyus Jones or some kind of player that's a one and done, you know, I think you're right. You take anybody you can get in this day and age in college basketball, because just about anybody can break through and kind of, you know, become that team. I mean, Wichita State, you know, they did it in a different way than teams like Kentucky have done it. And, you know, Louisville develops players over a number of years. You know, they were the team that you look at what Kentucky did this year and they did nothing with all these freshmen who are supposed to be, you know, the best players in the country. And, you know, next year it's going to be a whole lot more of that. But you look at what the Spartans can do, and you know, if they have a great season this year, maybe a player like a Tyus Jones and a Jahlil Okafor start looking more at Michigan State. But if they don't, they don't. And, you know, maybe you go with a guy like Ullis. Maybe you go with him anyway, and you just sign both of them. I wouldn't be opposed to that. I mean, you look at the depth at point guard on this roster. You know, you have Keith Appling, but he's going to be gone after this season. You have Travis Trice. He'll be a junior this year, so he's got one season after that. And, you know, you do have Denzel Valentine. And, you know, I'm not saying he's a pure point guard because I don't think that's the case. But, you know, we certainly saw that he can fit in there, you know, in spots, definitely. And he has been a big contributor. And going forward, I think he's going to be a very important player. And, you know, like we were talking about, a four-year guy, which he potentially is, it can really, you know, have a higher overall impact on the program than a one-and-done can. I mean, you look at Anthony Davis, and yeah, he was, you know, the number one pick. He led Kentucky to a national title. But then you look at a guy like Archie Goodwin this year, who was, you know, one of these top recruits. He went to Kentucky for a year. They lost to Robert Morris, and he left anyway. And, you know, and then Calipari is now scrambling. Well, he's not scrambling because he's got, you know, fleets of people who are coming in. But, you know, I think if we keep going in this one and done direction, you know, we learned the hard way that you're not always going to get those players. And, you know, you look at a team like Indiana and Tom Crean, where he's kind of running guys off the team so he can make room for these top flight recruits. And it seems like that's going to burn a lot of bridges if you're, you know, kicking Remy Abel, well, not kicking him off, but, you know, escorting him out of the program so you can make room for Noah Vonleh and these guys. It just seems like that's not the direction Izzo will go. I think either way, it'll be fine. You know, if we get Jones, great. If we get Ullis, great too. Either way, you can't lose when you have a guy like Tom Izzo coaching the team. So that's going to do it for our show today. I am Matt Ludke. Thank you, Alex Shard, for all your help today in the booth. You've been listening to WKAR East Lansing AM 870. Go have yourself a safe and pleasant evening, and we'll hear from you tomorrow.
This is Sports Talk from AM 870 WKAR.